When George Floyd was pulled to the ground by police officers in the US city of Minneapolis, he pleaded over 20 times, "I can't breathe." Those pleas were ignored, and the 46-year-old's final words would go on to be chanted at Black Lives Matter protests right across the country and then the world. Now, ahead of the 2-year anniversary of that killing, a new book digs deep into his family's history to ask who George Floyd was and what it was like to live in his America. The book is co-authored by Washington Post reporters Robert Samuels and Tolu Oleronipa. And Tolu joined me a little earlier.
It's so great to be with you.
This book draws on historical research as well as 400 interviews with a wide range of people, from the family of George Floyd to US President Joe Biden. After all of that, what's the picture you're left with of who George Floyd was?
Well, George Floyd was a complicated man. He was someone who had ambitions and dreams, and he was born poor and Black in America. And because of that, a lot of those dreams were diminished and derailed and deferred.
Please, I can't breathe. Please, man.
He was someone who saw himself as a potential Supreme Court justice, sitting on the highest court in the land of the United States. And he saw himself also as a rapper or an athlete. And every time he tried to pursue those dreams, he saw himself running into the strictures of American racism. They wanted to look at not only his death, which a lot of people know about, but the life that he lived over the course of 46 years. His family also experienced racism, and we wanted to show how pervasive that systemic racism was in his life.
You go right back into the archives here. You discovered that George Floyd's ancestors were slaves in America. They were freed under the Emancipation Proclamation. What did you learn about his family history, and how did it help you understand George Floyd better?
Well, one of the things we learned was that George Floyd actually had a history in his family of great wealth. His great-great-grandfather, who had been born enslaved, was able to amass more than 500 acres of land. This is land that, for a Black man in North Carolina, would have made him one of the richest people in that part of the state, and definitely one of the richest Black men in that part of the state. And all of that land was stripped away. It was lost in part because George Floyd's great-great-grandfather was preyed upon by unscrupulous business dealers, as well as, you know, tax authorities in North Carolina, who took advantage of him and essentially stripped every acre of land from him and made it to the point where he was not able to pass along any of that land to his descendants. And his descendants lived poor. They worked very hard, but they lived as sharecroppers, and without owning land, they weren't able to own their labor. Instead, they worked for others and they were cheated by others. And by the time George Floyd came onto the scene, he was a poor man, a poor boy, and his family had little to show for all of the decades of work they had spent in the land.
In the book, you document the increasingly serious criminal charges George Floyd faced as he got older. He spent 4 years in prison for involvement in an armed robbery in which a woman was hit in the face with a gun in front of her children. How did researching charges like those influence your view of George Floyd?
Yeah, we knew that if we were going to tell Floyd's story, we had to tell the full story. When it came to the more serious arrest, the one violent arrest on his record, and we spoke to as many people as we could to try to find out the details of what happened. And we learned that Floyd's was connected to this case through, you know, a police lineup that would not pass muster under today's standard. But Floyd did plead guilty in part because he felt that if he were to try to go to trial, he could face a much longer sentence. You know, he didn't think he'd get a fair trial as a Black man with a record in Texas. He was facing decades in prison. And when the state gave him the chance to plead guilty and, serve less than 5 years, he essentially took that as a deal, saying, you know, I could do this time, come back home and try to get on with my life rather than, you know, running the risk of getting convicted at trial and spending decades in prison. Now, he continued to maintain his innocence,
or he at least maintained that he was not the gunman in this scheme. And we found out as much as we could, and we talked to other people in the neighborhood who also corroborated that. They admitted that he had committed other crimes, but they said in this one he was falsely imprisoned, but he had to take the deal because there was not very many other choices for a Black man accused of being a robber. So we do hope readers will read this part of the book because it does reflect the reporting that we did. We want readers to come to their own conclusion about what happened.
Last year, police officer Derek Chauvin was sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for killing George Floyd by kneeling on his neck. You speak extensively to George Floyd's family in the book. What did that sentence mean for them?
Well, it was a measure of justice for them. They did want the police officer who killed their loved one to spend time in prison. They did look at the conviction and the sentence in isolation, saying that that was a measure of justice, but it wasn't the full story. It wasn't the full justice that they're looking for. They want there to be a much broader re-envisioning of how policing works so that other police don't feel like they can get away with abusing people. And they feel like if Chauvin had not been caught on camera, he might have gotten away with the murder of George Floyd.
Your skin color should not define who you are.
Amen.
It should never be a weapon.
George Floyd's family went on to become leading figures in the calls for police reform and racial justice in the United States. But talks to pass sweeping federal reforms in the wake of his death collapsed last year. Has any real reform happened since his death?
There has been reform on the local level, and I don't want to downplay some of the changes that have been done. There have been several police departments that have banned the kind of chokehold that was used on George Floyd. There have been police officers that have been convicted of other murders. And that's not something that we've seen very often in America, where police officers are actually convicted of killing people. So there have been changes, but they've been incremental. There has not been the kind of wide sweeping national level change or legislation that people were expecting or hoping for after Floyd died. And we saw this great outpouring of protesters and activism, both in America and across the world. There was this expectation that something would follow in terms of, you know, meeting the protesters halfway and providing some kind of legislation that would at least make them feel like their voices had been heard. When we look at this 2 years in hindsight, it does appear that many of those pushes and calls for activism have gone unheard, and instead the country has moved on, and instead there's been a backlash, actually, especially here in the US, to the idea of discussing racial justice or discussing race.
That's Tolu Olero-Nipa, who's the co-author of His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.